Finally, before we begin the People versus Colligan, I want to welcome our special guests today. For those who are here in the courtroom, you can see we are being visited today by the eighth grade class from the Denver Academy of Torah. The eighth grade class is, and their teacher, Mrs. Reifman, and I know some parents are here, although I'm not quite sure who all they are. The eighth grade class is studying the book To Kill a Mockingbird. And as some of you may remember, in that book, Tom Robinson is accused and convicted of a rape. It doesn't end there, though, because his lawyer, Atticus Finch, agrees to take the case up on appeal. And the students are here today to see what, as good as Harper Lee's writing may be, to hear today, they're going to see a real appeal, not a fictional one. And don't tell them what happens, because I understand they haven't got to that part of the book where the appeal is processed. So those who remember, don't tell them what happened in the book. I also want to thank the counsel who are present here today, both for the AG and for the public defender. They have agreed to meet with these students after the argument to talk about the case. And the students know something about the case because they've already heard mock arguments from lawyers. So with that, you don't need to tell us all the facts of the case. We've also read the brief. So with that, we'll call the first case, People versus Colligan.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Huff. I represent Mr. Colligan. I'm a public defender. My registration number is 34384. Because of time constraints involved, I think I'm only going to try to get into the Confrontation Clause issue, the first issue that I presented in my brief. And just to inform the kids a little bit of what a Confrontation Clause issue is, everyone in a criminal trial has the right to face their accuser. So anyone that's going to give testimony against you in a criminal trial, if you're the defendant, you have the right to sit there and have your attorney look them in the eye and cross-examine them and have the jury do the same thing as far as see their demeanor on the stand. And so that's what this issue is about. And I'm going to break my argument into two parts. First of all, I'm going to tell you why this is a Confrontation Clause issue and why it was preserved as such. And then I'm going to get to assuming arguendo that it's not a confrontation issue, assuming that we didn't preserve it, it's still reversible error under the hearsay doctrine. So first of all, I'm going to talk about why it's a Confrontation Clause violation. Everybody agrees, both the state and myself, that prior to the trial, we filed notice under 16.3.309.5, which is a request from the defense asking any reports, criminalistics, lab reports, anything like that, that the person who authored those reports that are going to come in against our client be called to testify. In other words, we don't want the prosecution just to be able to introduce, for instance, this piece of paper to the jury without someone coming in and saying, look, I authored this report here and I'm available for cross-examination and to answer questions about it. Now,
how does Dr. Markovchik, who's the author of that piece of paper, more or less,
yes,
fit the definition of a criminalist or other specialist under that statute?
Well, first of all, I don't think the statute should be read that narrowly, and I know that the Attorney General urges this court to do so, but if you actually read the language of the statute, it's not written simply in terms of technical, scientific, criminal lab type reports. It's written more broadly. For instance, the language says any report or the findings of a criminalistic laboratory. So that to me means the legislature intended that any report that is of a scientific nature, or it could also be comprised of something from a criminalistic laboratory, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's narrowed to just reports from criminalistic laboratories. It also speaks in terms of an employee or a technician of the criminalistic laboratory. Again, it's not limiting it to purely a lab analysis, such as testing for drugs or DNA or something to that effect. I read this more broadly as covering any reports, scientific in nature, that the prosecution intends to introduce against the defense.
So then it would supplant any rule regarding any expert witness report. And there's a rule that specifically addresses that, is there not?
Well,
wouldn't this supplant it if your interpretation is correct?
I am merely talking about this particular case. I can't speak that in every case with every expert under any circumstances that it would apply to them, and I'm not saying it supplants anything. If anything, it can be read in harmony with those other rules that require disclosure and in-person testimony. My point is, I don't read 16.3309 to be so narrow as to only cover things that come out of a criminalistic laboratory. To me, the legislature, by making a distinction between report or the findings of a criminal laboratory, was saying that any sort of report, technical, scientific in nature, which I would argue that this is, which has an analysis, comparison, or identification, falls under this rule.
It also says that the witness has to be notified. Is there anything in the record that says Dr. Markovchik was notified that they were requesting his presence?
Well, I think that is imputed to the prosecution. In other words, I don't know of a case where we file a request under 16.3309 and we actually have to mail a letter to the prosecution's witness. By filing that notice, we're giving them notice that they, if they intend to introduce those statements by that person, they need to make sure that that person is there for confrontation clause purposes. But even if this court doesn't read 16.3309 to encompass such things as Dr. Markovchik's report, we still included the confrontation clause in our notice. We still say that we're moving under the confrontation clause as well as the due process clauses of the constitutions, both federal and state, that we want results as to laboratory procedures. Now, undoubtedly, Markovchik did this in some sort of laboratory. Now, is it the mad scientist laboratory? No. But he is a scientific technician in the sense that he is making scientific conclusions, he's doing analysis, he's taking these injuries and actually determining that they did qualify as serious bodily injury. And in that terms, I think not only does he fall under 16.3309, but he would also fall under our specific request to confront any witnesses who had anything to do with laboratory procedures, such in this case.
Now, so I take it the report was never shown to the defendant before trial?
I don't know that, Your Honor.
Was Markovchik available to be subpoenaed?
I have no idea. But the point is, that's not our responsibility. We don't have to subpoena in people who are going to testify against us. All we have to do is tell the prosecution, if you're going to do that, we want them in person. We want to be able to exercise our confrontation clause rights as to that person and not allow his report in that's incapable of any impeachment, incapable of any cross-examination, incapable of the jury assessing his demeanor and his knowledge and his background. And I think we adequately did that. But taking the AG's position, which would be that this did not preserve the confrontation clause issue, we nevertheless objected to hearsay, which is precisely what this report is. And so even if this court decides or declines to address the confrontation clause issue in this point and put it in the standard of review of constitutional harmless error, it nevertheless is error that was preserved under standard harmless analysis.
Where in the trial, or where in your brief, do you address the alleged violation of the hearsay rule?
Well, when the report came in, we said, Your Honor, we object to this report coming in. It's hearsay.
I agree. There was an objection to trial on the basis of hearsay, not necessarily on the confrontation clause, which is what you argue on appeal. But where in your brief on appeal is the hearsay argument elucidated at all?
Well, the bottom line is we said, Your Honor, this is an admissible hearsay, regardless of what explanation the prosecutor is trying to bring it in for. It's long been accepted that reports like this, police reports, are exempted from any sort of business rule exception to hearsay. In fact, Hinojosa Mendoza, which is a case that I cited in my reply brief, and the Attorney General also cited, specifically says this exception, CRE 8036, is not available for documents prepared in anticipation of criminal prosecution. That's precisely what this is, was a document prepared in anticipation of criminal prosecution, and we objected. We may not have said that specifically, but we called it what it was, which was inadmissible hearsay.
Assume for a minute, Mr. Huff, that we were going to talk about this as a hearsay issue rather than as a confrontation issue, and that we agreed that it was not admissible as a business record. Tell me why it's not harmless error.
Well, and that was the final part of my argument, and I'd be happy to address that, because we basically have three witnesses who talk about serious bodily injury here, and that's the heart of the matter, is whether the victim, whether the evidence showed serious bodily injury. We, in our closing argument, disputed that she had suffered serious bodily injury. She got on the stand, the victim in this case, and said she, quote, had a lot of headaches, and her vision was blurry for months after, and she was hit on the head. Now, that alone, a jury could find, yeah, that's sufficient for serious bodily injury. And they can find that what Dr. Kao said was sufficient to find serious bodily injury. But that's not the standard. We're not talking about sufficiency here. We're talking about whether this was error, whether this was harmless error. And to reach the level of harmless error, it has to be a reasonable probability that this contributed to the conviction. So if we go over Arnold, the victim in this case, she just said, I had a lot of headaches. She said her vision was blurry and she was hit on the head. Maybe a jury would find that sufficient, maybe they wouldn't. What did Dr. Kao say? She said, I don't even recall this patient. I only treated her once. And the only thing that I can find that serious bodily injury is blurry vision. But the jury might have found that temporary blurry vision, as Arnold testified it was temporary, was not serious bodily injury. What sealed the deal on serious bodily injury was this report right here saying this is serious bodily injury. It has a seal on it. It has the state of Colorado. It looks very official. It informs the jury, basically, that this element was met. They could have easily determined that based upon Dr. Kao's testimony and based upon Arnold's testimony, there simply wasn't enough to establish serious bodily injury. However, when you put this into the mix, which basically tells them this is serious bodily injury, then it's evidently, it's necessarily harmful, much more harmful than the testimony of the others. I'm not saying that their testimony wouldn't, in a sufficiency context, be sufficient. What I'm saying is that there's a reasonable probability that it wasn't sufficient to this jury. And there's a reasonable probability that this thing telling them that this was serious bodily injury was sufficient and is what made them determine this was in fact serious bodily injury.
Even though Markovchik's reason for it being serious bodily injury was something other than blurry vision and headaches, was it not?
Yeah, he said that it was a facial laceration. Now, no one, that would result in permanent scarring.
So it could have been a facial laceration, or it could have been blurry vision and headaches. The jury could have believed either version of those descriptions and have come to a conclusion that it's serious bodily injury, and Markovic's testimony could have been completely disregarded. If you view the light most favorable to the prosecution, wasn't that a way that we could come out?
I would point this court to the prosecutor's closing argument then, because she says it better than I could. So the next question becomes whether she suffered serious bodily injury. Look no further than what Dr. Markovic said. Dr. Markovic says, yes, this is serious bodily injury. Now, he saw her a week after she was injured. It was serious bodily injury then. He made this report a month and a half later after she was injured. It was serious bodily injury. This, in my opinion, is what turned the tide. The jury could have, there is a more than a reasonable probability that based upon Arnold's and Kao's testimony alone, this jury would have found this victim did not suffer serious bodily injury. But in combination with this report that they can look at, that they can hold, that they took back to them in deliberations, which has a fancy seal on it, which has analysis on it, This is what could and had a reasonable probability of convincing them that there was serious bodily injury in this case. And if there are no other questions at this time, I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel?
May it please the court. My name is Molly McNabb, registration number 43804, and it is my honor to appear before this court on behalf of the people. Addressing the confrontation clause issue that the defendant spent his time on today, I'd like to first address why section 16.3305 or 309 is not applicable in this case, and then after dealing with that, move on to just the confrontation issue independent of this statute. This statute is a notice and demand statute that governs the time in which a defendant has to give notice in order to confront certain groups of people. It applies to classes of people and documents that are specifically articulated in the statute and is not a general objection to any and all documents that might come in trial on the basis of confrontation. The scope of the statute is unambiguous and the language is clear. It applies to criminalistics laboratories. The title of the statute is Laboratory Test Results, the admissibility of laboratory test results, and it specifically refers to not just laboratories, as defense counsel has asserted, but criminalistics laboratories. This is obviously not the situation we have here, which is an emergency room in a hospital and an attending physician who is examining a patient. The statute simply just is not that broad, and the defendant can cite no cases to support such a broad interpretation of the statute. To the contrary, all of the cases that have dealt with this statute very much reflect the limited scope of the statute and deal with laboratories that are traditionally associated with, like, the Colorado Bureau of Investigation laboratories that do things like identifying substances as Schedule II drugs, weighing those substances, doing footprint analysis, doing blood alcohol content analysis. Those are the kinds of things that are covered in this statute. Moving on, taking the statute out of the context of this case, we then move on to the confrontation clause issue. As the people have asserted in the brief, the defendant waived this issue by not raising it at all at trial. The objections at trial were explicitly on hearsay grounds, and defense counsel even said, "Trial court, one moment please, I need to make a record. I object on hearsay, this is hearsay." He said that twice, made the same objection twice, and that was it. There was no confrontation objection whatsoever.
Even if we were to agree to you, it would still be reviewable on appeal under the plain error standard, would it not?
Respectfully, Your Honor, the people contend that the issue is waived, and that is based on the case law from Melendez-Diaz, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, in which the U.S. Supreme Court acknowledges that confrontation clause is a right, like many other rights, that can be waived if it's not invoked. It's not a self-executing right. And the defendant, and I quote from the case, the defendant always has the burden of raising his confrontation clause objections. And the failure to do this can waive the confrontation clause issue altogether, and defense counsel can waive it by defense counsel's failure to raise that issue. So the people do contend that it is waived and should not be reviewed at all on appeal. However, Your Honor, should the court decide that it is reviewed under plain error, the people would contend that it does not rise to the level of plain error at all.
Do you agree that it's at least a testimonial document?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't see how there's any way of getting around the fact that it's on the district attorney letter.
That element of confrontation is met. It is a testimonial document.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. The witness wasn't available to be cross-examined.
No, Your Honor.
So how does it fall short? How could it not fall into the confrontation area if we look at it?
If the court does decide to review this issue, the people would contend that it does not, it does, it that the doctor should have been available to be cross-examined at trial. However, the failure to present the doctor does not constitute plain error. And this goes to the issue that defense counsel spoke about at length regarding the evidence that was presented at trial, including Dr. Cao, who did testify. She was another treating physician who is a peer of the doctor who signed the serious bodily injury report, and the victim's own testimony. And this testimony is cumulative to the information that's in the serious bodily injury report.
Ms. McMahon, is it cumulative to something, to all of the elements of serious bodily injury that can be proved? Because Dr. Cao testified to something different than Dr. Markovich, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And Dr. Cao's testimony is much broader and expansive than the information that's included in the serious bodily injury report. Everything in the report, Dr. Cao testified to at trial. So there's nothing that is special or unique about the information in the serious bodily injury report that the jury might have relied on.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. Did Dr. Cao say that there was serious bodily injury because of a facial laceration?
She did not connect those two that explicitly, but she did testify at length as to the laceration, that there were 16 stitches she personally did herself, and that there was permanent scarring on the victim's face. The doctor also testified and said explicitly that it was serious, in her opinion, it was serious bodily injury.
Is the jury asked to look at or given the opportunity to look at the victim's face?
Yes, Your Honor. The victim testified, and part of her testimony, the district attorney walked her through pointing out the different scars on her face and going through all of the different injuries that she had, pointing to her body as she was sitting on the stand in view of the jury. Additionally, there were photos that were admitted into evidence that were taken the day of the victim's testimony so that the jury could
have...
The
day of the injury, you mean?
No, the day of the testimony.
The photos were taken the day of the testimony?
Yes, to show the permanent scars that were on her face so that the jury had something to take into the deliberation room. Okay. As an example of the permanent disfigurement.
Well, Ms. McNabb, even if there was ample evidence that this woman was injured, I mean, she testified to it herself, and both of the physicians indicated that there was, wasn't the issue for the jury, the fairly narrow issue of whether this was bodily injury or serious bodily injury under one of these definitions that they were given? And wouldn't you agree with me that even seeing pictures of stitches, scars that somebody got, as a layperson, do I know that that would amount to substantial risk of serious permanent disfigurement? I mean, that's like, they had an expert say that, but without that expert, could I as a layperson conclude that that was serious bodily injury under that definition?
I believe so. I think that anytime you talk about permanent disfigurement, I would think that a layperson would think of scarring if they were to give an example of that. And there were just scars on her face. So it wasn't like there was a scar in a more remote place of her body. This was on her face.
It was a hairline, wasn't it?
I believe there was some on the hairline going down her back and her neck as well. And so, you know, these were visible and were apparent. And the doctor who did testify ultimately comes down to the fact that she testified to the exact same injuries that were on the serious bodily injury report, both the lacerations and the headaches, and went even further to say that she was diagnosed with a concussion and she's serious. She suffered from a blunt force trauma to the head and a closed head injury. And all of these things, she said, in her expert opinion, constituted serious bodily injury. There's no information on the serious bodily injury report that goes beyond what the doctor testified to at trial. So I think that the jury was given ample evidence that the definitions that they were provided with in their jury instructions were met as the expert testified.
Okay, well, I don't want to beat this to death, but Dr. Markovich's report said no when asked whether she had serious bodily injury defined as protracted loss or, you know, the substantial risk of permanent disfigurement, and he marked no. He went off on another definition of serious bodily injury. Or, I'm sorry, I'm switching it around. He said, no, she didn't have serious bodily injury based on the blurred vision or any of that stuff. He said, yes, only that the only definition that was satisfied was that 3.5 centimeter laceration on her hairline. And don't we have to, when assessing, gee, did the jury probably believe this or believe the other, keep in mind that Dr. Cowell was a medical resident and she had identified Dr. Markovchik as the person who founded the emergency medicine program at the hospital and had been there for 30 years. I mean, do you think the jurors might have borne that in mind when deciding which definition to go with?
I think what's more telling is that she testified that she personally sutured the laceration and that the victim sat on the stand and the jury could see the scars themselves. I think that, you know, when you look at the serious bodily injury report and that that the doctor circled yes to serious permanent disfigurement, that's exactly what Dr. Cowell testified to as well at trial, that about the laceration and the scarring. And in addition to all of that, she also testified about the blurry vision, about the concussion. So she was adding to the knowledge that was already, she was far surpassing the information that was already in the serious bodily injury report.
She testified that she did the stitches.
Yes.
She testified that it would leave a scar.
I don't believe she said that it would leave a scar. I don't remember that explicitly.
Did she opine that it constituted serious permanent disfigurement?
No, she did testify that it constituted serious bodily injury, though.
Dr. Cowell did?
Yes, she did.
Do you have a record set?
I do, Your Honor. It's page 48, and that's...
Okay, we can find.
Sorry, I do have page 40, and I just don't have the date of the doctor's testimony. But the prosecutor asks, and I quote, "Doctor, in your expert opinion, did the victim suffer serious bodily injury?" To which Dr. Cowell responded, "Yes."
But based on the laceration.
That was at the conclusion of all of her testimony. She was concluding that based on the concussion, the head trauma, the bruising, the facial lacerations, the blurry vision, that in her expert opinion and based on her review of the victim's medical records, that it constituted serious bodily injury.
If we look at this at hearsay, you haven't talked about that. You can see that this document was not admissible under the hearsay rule.
Yes, the people would concede that it would have had hearsay issues at trial. However, that was not briefed whatsoever on appeal. And the people would contend that should this court decide to look to hearsay in its opinion, that it would be a similar analysis as the plain error analysis, where it was harmless even though it came in, it was cumulative of the other evidence that was also admitted. So.
It was objected to at trial on the grounds that it was hearsay.
Yes, and
but
the,
it's not briefed on appeal that it's hearsay. Instead, they argued confrontation.
Correct. So the defendant would have abandoned his hearsay. The defendant has abandoned his hearsay claim on appeal because he did not raise it in his opening brief. There is a brief mention of it in the reply brief with regards to the standard of review, and. However, the reply brief is not the correct venue for raising an issue, especially not that late in the appellate process. So the people contend that is not an issue on appeal to be resolved.
And yet you nevertheless addressed it in your answer brief, at least the harmfulness of it.
I don't believe that we did, Your Honor. I think it was just a confrontation clause issue that we addressed on appeal. If there are no further questions, I thank the Honorable Court.
Can you go to a moment to look at the brief?
No, that's quite all right. I can.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
I want to first say I haven't abandoned anything. I am arguing and continue to argue this is a confrontation clause issue. Now, if this court does not find it's a confrontation clause issue, I argued that it was inadmissible hearsay. Now, maybe I didn't get into the specifics of the business records exception because it's well known that this wouldn't have come in, and the Attorney General has conceded that this was a hearsay document that wouldn't have been admitted as a business record exception. So there's no way this court could find that it was admissible as a business record exception. Not only does the AG concede that it wasn't, but the case law is very clear. Documents like this are not. My primary argument is it's a confrontation clause, but I'm also saying if you want to analyze it as just a hearsay objection, which is what I've been talking about, it's still harmful, even under the regular harm analysis. And I want to point out two things about the facts, and I want to kind of correct the Attorney General. The jury only heard two times about SVI. One time was Dr. Cowell saying that her blurry vision constituted serious bodily injury. The other time was Dr. Markovich in this report saying it wasn't blurry vision, it was a 3.5 centimeter scar to her head. Based upon that, the jury could there was a reasonable probability that the jury could have found blurry vision does not constitute serious bodily injury, particularly when Arnold testified that it was blurry months after. Maybe she's not even experiencing blurry vision anymore. The point is, there is a reasonable probability that the jury could have dispensed with the blurry vision serious bodily injury and adopted what was put in front of them, the laceration serious bodily injury. And because this report shouldn't have come in, this case should be reversed.
Counsel, thank you very much. Your time is up. The case will stand. We promise the 8th grade will send a copy to them as well. We are going to take a brief recess now to let the students take themselves out of the courtroom, and the counselor just argued to meet with them. We'll be back in about 5 minutes.